You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Feeling stuck in your job? Bank of America's The Academy for Consumer and Small Business helps you develop a long-term career path. Through peer mentorship, immersive programs, and a variety of clear and distinct paths, you can reach the next level in your career. Take your first step towards a long-term career path at careers.bankofamerica.com. And now, on with the show. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. Last October, I was introduced to a quirky little television series on AMC called Lodge 49, and I've been raving about it to friends and family ever since. But the problem I run into every time is that it's almost impossible to describe this modern-day fable. That's because Lodge 49 is by far the most original show on television. Actor Wyatt Russell plays a disarmingly optimistic ex-surfer in Long Beach, California, who finds himself drifting after the death of his father and collapse of the family pool business, until one day he decides to join a struggling fraternal order with a mystical past known as the Lynx, setting him off on a quest to find magic, both literal and metaphorical. Did I do it justice? Probably not. But here's the thing. Lodge 49 is about so much more than that, and it's a really amazing show. So today I'm going to delve into it with Wyatt Russell himself and see if season 2 of this touching and often hilarious show just might reveal the secret of life. First off, Wyatt takes a crack at explaining Lodge 49 better than I ever could. We talk about how the show speaks to the isolation of modern social media culture and our longing for fellowship and meaningful relationships. We discuss the allure of ancient fraternal orders, the importance of embracing everyday magic, and curiosity about the places and the people we all too often drive right by. Wyatt reminisces about his previous career as a professional hockey player and the injury that sidelined him from hockey but inspired him to pursue a career in film and television. He recalls getting his first big break just when he was about to give up on acting, following in the footsteps of his famous parents, Kurt Russell and Goldie Hawn, and what they taught him about keeping celebrity in perspective. Coming up with Wyatt Russell in just a moment. Folks, you know actor Wyatt Russell from his memorable performances in films like J.J. Abrams' historic horror movie Overlord, Richard Linklater's Everybody Wants Some, This Is 40 and 22 Jump Street, as well as one now classic episode of Black Mirror. But he's best known as the lovably lost eternal optimist Dud on AMC's quirky and acclaimed series Lodge 49. Lodge 49 returns for season 2 August 12th. Wyatt Russell, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
I am such a fan of this show. From day one, you guys had me, and I'm constantly telling people about it. You're recommending it to friends and family, but I'll be honest, I have a hell of a time trying to describe this show to anyone. I end up rambling all over the place, talking about Long Beach and mysticism and alchemy and social media culture. I don't make any damn sense to anyone. So I'm just going to put it to you. When friends ask you, hey, Wyatt, what are you working on these days? How do you pitch this show?
That is how I pitch the show. Yeah. I pitch the show. The short pitch is an ex-server from Long Beach mm-hmm. got bit by a snake who can no longer surf anymore, finds a fraternal order, and a elder knight takes him under his wing. That's the pitch, right? That's what's happening in the show. To the main character, that's what's happening. But the show's not about that, which is why I like the show. The show is an allegory for life. If you've ever read The Hero Has a Thousand Faces, the Joseph Campbell book, mm-hmm. it much more is along the lines of that and follows a true arc of a big, massive story from beginning to end. There's a grandiosity to the show inside of the storytelling that I find big and exacerbated and exaggerated, and it's all set within a very normal limitations of the normal world, mm-hmm. of the known universe, but makes you believe, or leads you to believe sometimes, that there's much more going on around you than meets the eye.
Yeah.
That to me is what is special about the show, because it recreates your life in some way, mm-hmm. shape, or form.
Yeah. It's about the hidden magic in everyday life.
Every day.
And of course, the title is a reference to Thomas Pynchon's novel, The Crying of Lot 49. Did you ever read Pynchon before you took on this part?
Tried. No? I've read 150 pages of Gravity's Rainbow.
Oh, yeah.
Tried to read Crying of Lot 49. You really have. I said to Jim when I started reading it, I was like, "Man, I need a guide, I need a spirit guide here, because it's a funny thing. It is like the show in a way. The show watches almost like you read a novel in a weird way, mm-hmm. where there's so many characters, there's so much going on. Everybody's in their own world, but their worlds connect. Yeah. And in the same way, in a Pynchon novel, you kind of have to just keep going." In a weird way, right. You kind of have to keep reading. Gravity's Rainbow doesn't
it's kind
start
of a
to
slow burn.
You start to feel it. You start to feel a book like Gravity's Rainbow when you just keep going, and you internalize the words and the sentences in a way, because it's so it's very unorthodox when you read something like that.
Oh shit! Freaked me out.
I felt like
someone
the walls
sneaking
were,
up behind
were coming
you.
Down.
Yeah, yeah. Speaking of magical
speaking
things.
Speaking of magical, yeah, it was like a magical doorway right behind me. Yeah. And someone walked out of it and was, you know. But it was, it's like that. It's I do liken it to that, where you just kind of all of a sudden find yourself in the world of, and mm-hmm. you catch yourself almost in a dream going, oh man, this is a really kind of a cool place to be.
Yeah, and there's just so much that's Pynchon-esque about this show. You have the setting in Southern California and this blurring of the lines between reality and mysticism, the eccentric characters, the weirdly anachronistic secret society.
Right.
I mean, what's not to love? And especially today, I feel like Lodge 49 seems to have come at just the perfect moment in our culture, because we're just so siloed in our own little worlds. We're only communicating with people we agree on, and only communicating with them over technology, not face to face. It's so isolating. And in fact, I think not that long ago, I read somewhere where a bunch of psychologists have agreed that the number one mental health crisis in America isn't like the opioid epidemic, suicide, and all that. It's loneliness that's at the root of all of these things. And I think there is just this longing for the kind of fellowship that Dud finds in the lodge.
It's a good question, and it's an interesting one that you bring up that study, where I wonder if the tools that were available to scientists 20, 30, 40 years ago that are available now would find the same thing. Because we've always needed these places. These places have always existed. Places for people to come together in face-to-face real life and have a sense of community that you feel as if your life has a meaning more than just what you're doing day-to-day.
Right.
And how it affects, and how that can affect other people in your immediate life and also in your social circles outside of your immediate family. And that's what Lodge is. At its core, is understanding the power of a relationship made for almost sometimes just for the sake of a relationship to be had.
Mm-hmm.
That's important in life. And I'm a pretty solitary person. I'm an introverted person.
Yeah.
And there is a power in introversion if you have others around you who understand that about you. You can't, mm-hmm. but you can't live on an island. Right. Human beings are not designed to do that.
Right.
And that aspect of our culture now, where you have a phone, it makes you feel connected to others.
Mm-hmm.
And it does do a good job of keeping you connected in a way, right?
Yeah, in a superficial way.
In a superficial way that can lead to a deepening of a relationship later in life, mm-hmm. Later in the week, if you actually act on making that relationship something that you want to be a tangible one. But for the most part, those technological meetings, relationships end up staying stagnant in that world, and you don't meet face to face.
Yeah.
And it would be nice to have a Lodge 49 to go around to.
Yeah, for sure. And I read that you don't do social media. Is that right?
No.
None at all. Huh?
No, I don't know. It's the same. No. I always loved, like, when Facebook came out, I was probably like 17 or 18 when I could get it. Cause I lived in Canada. It took a minute for it to get to Canada. It was like only schools for a little while. And I wasn't in school at the time. I was a little late to the party, but not late to the party where everybody could end up getting it. So I finally went to school and I got a school email. That was what it was. My school email.
Okay.
Email,
yeah. Email. That was back when you had to do it through a school, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And so it was really, it was really great because it served a great purpose.
Mm-hmm.
It allowed you to connect with your friends only. So you had to be a friend with that person. There was no public, it was, I want to get to know you, or I know you very well. And now we have a deepening of our relationship. Then it exploded into this massive worldwide thing where people were using it to market themselves.
Right.
Which I thought was strange. So I didn't do that.
And then it almost went from personal to impersonal.
Completely. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't on that trend. That felt weird.
Yeah.
Then Instagram came. Well, then it was Twitter and Instagram. Twitter I never got. And like, still don't understand. Instagram I totally got because now I'm sharing my moment mm-hmm. with my best friends.
Yeah.
Totally was on board. And then it evolved into marketing yourself as a brand,
right.
Which I understand for some people is a really great way to make money. If you have the self-control and a great head on your shoulders, I think there's no reason why not to, you know. But for me, I just didn't care for other people to know those parts of my life.
Yeah.
I just don't. And if I wanted to be an actor, I felt as if I wanted to do the things that I wanted to do, it wasn't going to behoove me to see me cooking eggs and making jokes because it does take away, it does a little bit from the mysticism of who is that person? What do they do?
Right, right.
You have those questions about people, and there's people who I really respect who don't do it, and I have those questions about them. So I didn't do it not out of thinking it was a bad thing. I think it's actually a very good thing, oddly. I don't do it, but I do think, think it serves more positive than it does negative.
Okay.
Because there's a lot of people that connect over Instagram, Facebook, Instagram, the ones that I've known, who have a sickness or an ailment or something that I can't get community mm-hmm. for the thing that I have. Right?
Right, right.
And there's a lot of people with
that makes a lot of sense.
Disease or whatever the hell it is. Mm-hmm. And they can connect with somebody a world away mm-hmm. and make them feel as if they're in it together.
Yeah.
And there's a support system there. I've seen that work in a way that's very special, which I would never want to go away. But I don't want to be a part of it.
Yeah, but it must be weird too for you. I mean, if people don't know, your parents are Kurt Russell and Goldie Hawn. So you probably, I assume, kind of grew up thinking that celebrity was like this byproduct of something else. It's like you do something and celebrity is the thing that comes along with it or the thing that you put up with because you love this other thing that you're doing so much. Now it's the end game. That's the goal, just to become a celebrity.
Right.
Without there being any there behind
it. It's very odd to me, because celebrity always seemed like a hindrance. Mm-hmm. The celebrity aspect of it. What comes with it is money and access, which of course everybody wants, and I want too. But the idea that you'd want to be famous, or you'd want to have celebrity attached to your name just because.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody when they get there is going to realize it's a cold, hard rock that you're going to be living under, because it's very lonely.
Yeah.
If you don't, if you engage with it that way, mm-hmm. if it's really not just a byproduct, and it was something that if the byproduct is the thing that you're going for as your whole meal, you're going to have issues.
Yeah.
You know, that doesn't end well.
Yeah. And this whole show seems to sort of be about, you know, valuing the relationships that are real versus the things that aren't real. And I guess that's one of the things that I enjoy about it, and especially kind of this anachronistic idea of the fraternal order, because it seems like that's something of my father's generation or his father's generation. You know, I'm always hearing how like these clubs like the Elks and the Shriners, the Masons are kind of slowly dying off as their old members die off. Uh-huh. And it makes me wonder why that is. I mean, do you think that we're just so self-absorbed that we avoid any type of obligation like that?
That's a good question.
Or is it maybe that, you know, just a lot of people are, I don't know, afraid to admit that they're not 100% emotionally self-sufficient, and they view sort of this innate fellowship with your community as some sort of weakness?
I think that it's a byproduct of what we've just been talking about, mm-hmm. in that requires time.
Yeah.
It requires time out of your day. It's an investment.
Yeah.
That we're so driven to believe that every ounce of time that we spend is an investment in our future. Mm. And the investment needs to have an ROI.
Yeah.
and that ROI usually needs to be seen by money,
mm-hmm.
and or success in some level towards your working goals. Mm. Where also back a few years ago, you could work as a postman, you could work as a roofer. I mean, you still can, and some of the trade industries are actually, you know, they need people. But you could work in those industries and go take time off with the people that you're around, and share experiences with them. And it wasn't seen as a chore. It was seen as something that was fun to do. The other aspect of it that's really great that people don't know about as much, they just look at, they're just sort of old dudes with, you know, time to kill, is that they do, there's a strong element of charity in all of those Masons, the Elks. Like, in order to become an Elk, because I know someone who is an Elk, you have to do something for the community.
Right. You don't just show up whenever you feel like it.
Drink beer whenever you feel like it. It's a commitment. Yeah. Yeah. And in a world in which every aspect of using your phone, every aspect of email, of work, of your family feels like it's taking your time away, mm-hmm. The last thing in the world you're going to say to yourself you want to do is go join some place that you're going to put your phone away and put all the other things away, because it feels like taking a step in the wrong direction if you're not going to enjoy yourself. And it really is. I think that there's a big part of people's lives right now specifically where you have to look at your life and say, when have I gotten to the point of diminishing returns, mm-hmm. in my work life? I get there in my own work life where I have to look at myself and go, is this worth it? Or is it better to not work right now and go spend 2 or 3 months and not make as much money? I get it, but have a better attitude for when I'm going into my next project. Mm-hmm. That's an important thing. Don't work, kill yourself working overtime.
Yeah.
Because what's the point? What are you working for? You know, you have to find that balance. And
It's weird because I feel like more than ever, we're breaking down our lives into increments of time.
Yeah.
And we're playing them like cards.
Right.
We're like, okay, is this a wise way to use this 30 days? Or should I be doing that? We're really analyzing the trade-off like probably never before.
Well, the weirdest part about the Instagram thing to me is that when you become a commodity and you've made yourself a commodity, mm-hmm. not necessarily owning a business and pumping your business on Instagram, but yourself, when you have become the commodity that you are selling shampoo or soap or tea, or, you know, fit tea or whatever.
Yeah.
And, but you're the commodity. Your entire life of every minute of your day now is about work, selling yourself as the thing for people to buy.
Yeah.
And
I'm the brand. I hate
it's hard,
man. Referring to themselves as a brand.
As a brand. It's like, it's a little bit soul stealing. And the more you can get away, it's like, okay, now it's great. But if you can try and diversify the brand to be where you don't have to be one thing, that'd be good.
You're more than a brand.
Than a brand.
Coca-Cola is a brand. People are better than that.
I think so too. But that's an interesting part of capitalism where it's the greatest part in the same breath. I can literally, out of thin air, take a few pictures of myself, and if people are interested in whatever the hell I am or my life is, I can make money off of that.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're happy doing that and traveling the world, and I see these pictures of people playing with pigs and, you know, bikinis and girls wearing thongs and Fiji, if you can do that and be happy and make money, I don't have a problem with it, because you're... As long as you're giving back to the world in some way, that's fine with me. But it's when people start to, that inevitably ends up turning inwards, and you turn inwards on yourself, and now everything is a mirror, and you can't look past yourself, I would imagine, for, you know, until it all comes crumbling down. Which is, hard not
today.
To.
Who knows?
Yeah. But it's an interesting, it's a very interesting question.
Yeah. And I feel like the show kind of addresses our commercial culture and this kind of disposable society. In fact, even the physical building of the lodge in Lodge 49 seems to be something of a metaphor, because it's one of these relatively nondescript places, slightly derelict buildings that you find in a place like Long Beach. And you could probably easily drive by there 100 times and never even notice it. But the show almost invites viewers to look deeper and discover sort of the magic that seems ordinary at first glance.
It's what I find interesting about living in the world, especially living in LA, is you can drive by anything. And if you choose, when I was a kid, I used to you drive by a bus stop, and I would always look at somebody walking down the street, cross whatever, they'd have a backpack on and a walking stick, and I'd always wonder, where are they going? What are they doing? What's going through their mind, and where are they going to end up when they get to their destination?
Yeah.
And everybody has that thing inside them that's a unique element that makes you you, and nobody else like it. And you will experience things that no one else will experience that feel like magic.
Yeah,
a feeling inside of you that feels that was magical. Oh my God, that was so cool. It's fleeting, and it goes away like that. And to me, Lodge is about a guy who's constantly looking for that moment. You're trying to find that moment and make that moment tangible, and doesn't quite understand yet that moment that you're searching for, that you're constantly trying to grab that brass ring or whatever that feeling is, are only things that can happen to you.
Yeah.
If you open yourself up to the experience, you can't force that feeling. It won't happen if you're constantly on the search for it. But you have to keep yourself open, and you have to be able to walk through those doors when you're asked to, or when they're presented to you, because that's what makes life fun. That keeping the possibility for magic.
And I love what you said about just watching a guy at a bus stop and wondering, what's his story? Where's he headed?
Right.
Because it's strange to think that everyone is the most important person in the world to themselves. Like the way that you and I feel about ourselves.
Yeah.
Like to me, I probably think that my needs and everything are way more important than yours, and vice versa.
Right.
And like everyone in the world feels that way.
Right.
And I think that that's part of the genius of your character on this show, is that at first glance, when I first started watching the show, he's like this irrepressible optimist who you kind of see as hapless and naive. But he slowly reveals himself to be this quiet genius, because he has this understanding and acceptance of people being people. And as much as he finds wonder in the world, people don't really surprise him that much. You know, when someone does something shitty, he might be like, oh, you know, come on, man, really? But it doesn't shock him. I mean, deep down, he seems to get human nature in that people act out of self-interest, and sometimes people turn out to be phonies. You know, he can still empathize with them, and he doesn't let it shake his beliefs in the essential goodness of people. I mean, it makes me wish there were more people like that today, because no one wants to put themselves in someone else's shoes today.
That, to me, hits it on the head entirely. Thank you for for seeing that.
You're most welcome.
I think it's fun to play, because when you have someone who seemingly his goal in life is very simple,
mm-hmm.
and he says it a few times, and it is when someone asks him, if you could anything in the world, what you could do anything in the world, what would it be? He very simply and very easily says, well, it's easy, I clean pools. That's all he wants to do.
Yeah.
So when you have when you're content with something simple in life, you just want it to be, mm-hmm. I just want to be happy, and that's the truth.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want much. I just want to be able to clean a pool. That's it. It's you've set up a character who's pure in a way, who has pure intentions at least, because what he wants doesn't require anybody else to fail.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't require, it's in him. It's inside mm-hmm. of him, and it's pure. So when you see the world through the eyes of that person, sometimes they'll say some things that are totally naive, and then sometimes they'll hit on things that are seemingly so obvious, but because we've convoluted the way we look at things, it's seen as some sort of prophetic, interesting, wow, I didn't think of that, kind of way of looking at the world. And playing that's great, because of course what you're going to end up doing is when you set that up as the characters want, you're going to have to get the simple life of mm-hmm. cleaning a pool and having a beer on a Sunday by the beach with your friends. That's the end goal. You're going to jump through hoops of fire to get there.
Okay.
You know, and that's our story, is that to get to that simple moment that you so long for, is going to be a lot of trials and tribulations on the way to learning how to be in that moment.
Mm-hmm. But the question is, would he still be longing to be a pool man if he were already a pool man? Because the whole story revolves around the fact that his father dies and loses their pool business. And all he wants in some ways is just to go back to the way things were. If he was in that moment before that, would he still want that?
Of course.
Would that still be the goal?
I think that's a great question, and it's the question. And Jim, at the end of the season, Dud expresses that, and it expresses an awareness of what you just said. Now, mm-hmm. that's I won't say what he said, because it's sort of in episode 10, and it is, in a way, the moment in the it's his learning moment mm-hmm. in the show this year, but it's very, very true, and the show does a good job of keeping it along the lines of reality that way, of mm-hmm. understanding. I know you want this, but you wouldn't want this if you hadn't been through the things that you think you didn't mm-hmm. want to go through.
Right.
Which we've all been through. Everybody, no matter what class, no matter what color, no matter what it is, someone has been, when trying to complete their story and get people to see them as they want to be seen, you will go through things, and things will happen to you that you don't want and wish didn't happen. Mm-hmm. And if you're strong enough, and if you can weather the storm enough, and that comes with varying degrees of difficulty. Yeah. That is not a one size fits all problem. But if you're able to do that, for the most part, you, I believe, as Dud is learning, will get to the other side and will have a very clear view mm-hmm. of what it was that got you there, and that it was the thing that you thought you didn't want.
Yeah, and I want to talk about that, because it seems like that's sort of a personal thing for you too, because, you know, here you have Dud, who's a surfer dude who can't surf anymore because he has a debilitating snake bite followed by a debilitating shark bite.
Right.
And, you know, I know that in your case, prior to acting, you were actually a professional hockey player until you got injured, and that ended your career. Do you relate to Dud in the sense that you had to give up something that you loved because of an injury, and I guess probably felt that there was sort of this cosmic unfairness to life for a while?
Yeah, I mean, I was raised with the understanding that cosmic unfairness is part of the fairness of life.
Yeah.
And in my case, it was very apparent from a very young age that nobody cared about my struggle, nor should they. Mm. Why would they? I'm a privileged white kid whose parents are famous people. But they understood that you're going to have struggle, and that your struggle will matter, and that making your struggle matter is actually an important part of your learning process. But guess what? Nobody gives a fuck about what your struggle is.
Right. Your struggle only matters to you.
And if you become the type of person who thinks that like your struggle should matter to everybody, either you're picking the right thing to talk about, or you're getting into a world of self-pity, and it's like, in my case, that's what that would be, right? It's like, look how hard it is. Really? Like, really?
Yeah. And then you write a book like Mein Kampf.
There you go. Yeah. So what I, with my life, when I started playing hockey, it was very much about that in terms of me understanding that this is going to be the thing that gives me an identity. This is going to be the thing that I identify with the most and gives me self-worth, right? Because it was difficult, and it's objectively difficult. You can't look at that sport and say, I could do that.
Yeah.
You know, most people be like, how is it possible? It takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of time. It takes commitment.
Yeah. Yeah. So I couldn't even play football. You know, this is a sport that almost requires you to go out and get beat up every day.
Right. Yeah. So in my case, it felt good because I knew that if I got good at it, then I'd be undeniably good at something. Mm-hmm. And it gave me an identity. So I traveled that world, and it was very difficult because there was a lot of people who didn't like who my parents were. And that was also... What?
Who doesn't love Goldie Hawn and Kurt Russell?
As a fan of them, sure. But when your kid all of a sudden is now competing against that kid for a job on a hockey team, and you're around the age where it really matters, and people are looking at their kids going, my kid has a shot of getting drafted into the WHL, or getting a shot at getting a Division I scholarship, or playing on the junior team. And now here comes this kid who's seemingly got everything going for him in the world. He can't be a son of actors. He can't be from California. He can't be like all of these things and a good goalie. Like, that's unfair. Mm-hmm. So what you're fighting against. And I always understood that that was okay for them to feel, but I was going to prove them wrong. Mm-hmm. And that felt good to prove them wrong because it was easy to, because all I had to do was play well. Numbers don't lie. When it got time for me, I went through a lot of injuries and had a lot of issues with injuries from the time I was about 19 to 22. And then at 24 was my last year. And as soon as I got injured for the last time, my hip was a disaster. It exploded, and it was just like there was no way I was coming back. Called my dad, and he was in the locker room crying. But it was a relief.
Really?
Yeah, because it was like someone told me it's over for you.
Yeah.
You're done.
Yeah.
And stop doing this. You don't need to beat your head against a brick wall for the rest of your life to prove to somebody that you're good at this or that you've earned something in your life. You did it. So take what you will from that experience and move on. But I didn't feel as if something was unfair. I mean, I could say that there were unfair moments, sure. But as a whole, like what you said before, looking back on things, I would never change a single thing to get to where I am now, because I do have an understanding of how people act in certain situations that I recognize. That if I wasn't put in that situation before, I don't think I'd recognize wrongdoing as easily. Yeah. Pretty good going, you're not in it for the right reasons.
Yeah. Yeah. And I have to imagine that, you know, if you had kids and coaches or whatever that were jealous of you or kind of gunning for you because your parents were celebrities, I have to imagine that it was even more so when you decided to get into acting. Is that part of the reason that you didn't go into acting initially?
Well, yeah, part of the reason I didn't go into acting was because I felt like it was like what everybody did, and also everyone said, why don't you just become an actor? Because it's so like it's right there. And it was, I would go, because I'm not an actor, I'm a goalie, mm-hmm. and I'm good at it.
Yeah.
It's not a pipe dream. I'm good at this. So it was all about a little bit of rebellion, all about proving people wrong, creating my own identity, blah, 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 blah. When I finally did say, fuck it, I'm just going to do it. I'm just going to try it. See if I can make some money. And see what this life's about and what there is to learn. And what I found out was really great. It was in acting and in the auditioning process specifically, everyone wants you to be good. Like, nobody is there wanting you to be bad.
Yeah, that's true.
And in hockey or any sport, everybody on the other team, including some of your own teammates, are hoping that you fail.
Yeah.
And when I got into those rooms, I really felt support, as in, mm-hmm. we want you to be good.
We want you to be the guy we're looking for.
We want you to come in and show us that you're the guy.
Yeah.
And so when people talk about competition, there's competition. Who's up for the role? And who's, mm-hmm. it's like, fuck me, you guys, this is not a competition. There's seriously no winning or losing. I've been a part of winning and losing. When you win a game, you win a game. When you lose a game, you lose a game. Yeah. And there is an opposing force on the other side literally trying to stop you from winning.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing like that in movies. Mm-hmm. Everybody
There's
is
no
on your side.
There's no point system in movies.
No, it's all subjective.
There's always more roles.
Always more roles. Yeah. There's always people creating more things, and you're going to be right for the things that you're right for, and you're not going to be right for the things that you're not right for. Mm-hmm. And so that relieved a lot of stress on me for getting roles or trying to win a role or lose a role. And I was like, oh my God, like that is so far from how I think about it.
Yeah.
I'm so happy for somebody when they get a part. You know, there's been a bunch of things where I haven't gotten and somebody else gets it. And I go, that is they're perfect for it. That's exactly who should play this part. And so that it set me up good for that. It set me up well for the mindset was good.
And I want to ask about your first big break, because I understand that when you went in for that audition, you were pretty much thinking about being done with acting, right?
Yeah. It was like a big break in that it wasn't a big break in terms of me being seen a lot and working a lot. You know, 22 Jump Street was probably my big, quote unquote, big break.
Right.
But it wasn't my personal big break.
Mm-hmm.
And this was Jim Mickle was doing a movie called We Are What We Are, and I was just done. I couldn't get a job. I couldn't figure it out. I didn't think I was good at auditioning. I didn't think that what I was good at was picked up by an audition well. I was just not good at it. And I was insecure about certain things and going in and trying to be something for somebody else and not really paying attention to just do it the way you're going to do it. And if it works, it works. And if it doesn't, it doesn't. I was trying to be something for other people a lot. So when I went in to Jim, I just said, look, here's my insecurities. Here's what I think I'm good at. And here's what I think I'm really not good at. And I'm having a really tough time. And I don't know. And I don't love it. And that was my big problem, was I don't love it. Like I lived for hockey. Mm-hmm. I loved it. It was everything. I woke up at 6:30 on Saturday mornings and I loved doing it, because you go to the rink and you have your coffee and it's a lifestyle that I was just so into.
Right, right. Well, I mean, I always hear of actors who love acting, but I never meet an actor who loves auditioning.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, right. But so, exactly. But I'd never had the experience of, I didn't even like acting, right? I'll be honest about that. I went out, I did jobs, I had work. But I had like a 4-day job here. I had a 2-day job here. I had a 3-week job here. I just didn't like it. It was like,
it's almost like a gig economy.
I'm a freelancer. I go, I don't make any friends. I don't know what the fuck I'm doing. I just go in and I say the lines, and this is not, you know, what that fun. And then when Jim said, great, let's do it, because we had this audition and he came in and just, I think, did it so well and so perfectly. He had the expertise to do the audition the way he cut it together. He asked me, like, how would you like to do it? And I said, well, I'd like to do it like a scene. Like, I think it'd be cool to do the scene if you're going to do the audition.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's logical. Yeah.
My feet are here. If you want to shoot the, my feet in the bowl that they're supposed to be in, you, yeah. you have everything. Shoot the scene. You get a close-up of me and then cut away to something, you know, like... And I didn't say it like that, but I think he wanted to do...
You were basically telling him how to direct.
Yeah, right. Okay. But I think he wanted to do that anyway. I think he liked the idea that I liked to do that. Or that's the way I thought that I was best going to be seen or whatever. So he did it. He did it for... I think he did it for everybody, and I think he was going to do it that way anyway. But he really was so great towards me and made me feel very comfortable. And I got the part, and he said, I hope you're good at acting, because... I like you as a person. So we went to upstate New York, and I had my first real experience of what it was like to be on a movie set with people who loved making movies. Mm-hmm. I was there for a month, 4 or 5 weeks, and I got to work with Michael Parks, and it was like, it was just, and Julia Garner was in the movie. It was awesome. It was such a fantastic experience. And it got me to understand why you want to do this, why I'd want to work for, I mean, you make no money and you're doing that, like some of those small indie movies, but why you'd want to. And he gave me my first real part, and I was a part of a process, and I was a part of people who loved doing it every day. It was just so fantastic. And so it opened my brain to the possibilities of what this job can be.
And I want to say that once you left hockey, your first foray into entertainment was actually taking a directing class.
Yeah.
Do you still write or direct much, or do you still have aspirations to do that?
I have. It was a directing class. It's what I wanted to do because I loved the idea of telling stories. That, to me, is exciting. You know, that I go to bed thinking about it. I wake up thinking about it. And as I... wanted to move into being in the movies, I didn't want to spend 10 years trying to get something made, because I'd just done that in a way where you're trying to prove to everybody something. And it was like, I want to go make money. I don't want my parents to have to pay for my life. If I run out of hockey money, I don't want to go back to that place while I'm trying to get a movie made. And I thought it'd be a great way to involve yourself on set and involve your each day, go to the sound department or go to the grip department or go to the electrical department and just watch how they do stuff and see what their qualms are and their difficulties. And it was a really nice way of getting to know how the whole machine works. And I do have all types of ideas. I'm in the process of developing things as a producer, which is a lot of fun as well. But there are a few ideas I have that I'm on the verge of saying, okay, I would like to do this as a director. I love talking to actors. I love seeing what actors can do. I'm not that dumb. I don't care, honestly, as far as what that is for me. It doesn't give me a huge rush. I like being able to serve a director and to give them what they want. And seeing other actors do incredible things, I think it really is cool. I just think it's awesome when somebody can take something and they change it, or they elevate it into something different that you didn't even know was there. And the rehearsal process is so much fun to find out how you're going to shape the story. And I think that it was important and is important continuing for me to be the type of person who looks at a story and tries to make the best story I possibly can. And that is, and to do that well and to do that right is a learning process. And you see what works and you see what doesn't. And eventually you just have to kind of step out and say, hey, fuck it, I'm going to do it. But I've always wanted to do it right.
Yeah.
I don't want to just do it ever as a vanity project. I want to do it because this is a good story.
Yeah.
You know, and so...
I think you'd be great at it. I mean,
thanks.
You seem to have a real team mentality. You root for people and you have a very definite point of view.
Yeah.
That comes in handy as a director.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Well, that's the fear, right? Is that now all of a sudden your point of view is out there and someone says, man, I don't like your point of view.
Shit.
Your point of view sucked. You're like, oh, fuck. I wish it wasn't, but I'm sorry. You know, that's sort of like, that is the hang up. That's the fear of failure.
Yeah. Well, that's what social media is for.
So. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you know, before we go, I want to give you a belated congratulations. I know you got engaged in December.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
Now, your parents have this amazing 35-year relationship, but they've never actually taken that step of getting married. What made you want to take the plunge and make it official?
I don't know. I think it's just, I think it was important to do. I think that when I thought about it, when I really thought about it, that's my example, right? Like they didn't get married. So to me,
right.
The idea of marriage,
a lot of young people would be influenced heavily by that.
Yeah. Marriage being codified by the state is like a little weird to me. The idea that, you know, we're going to make it so fucking impossible for you not to be together.
Yeah.
You know, it's going to be this whole litigious process. You're going to have to spend thousands of dollars. Yeah. Trust me. Just stay with the person, be miserable. It's fine. That was always, there's a turnoff there to me. Uh-huh. But when I thought about it, I thought it was important to say in front of all your friends and family that I'm going to try my best to do it with you.
Yeah.
I think that's important. I think that is important. And I think that's probably something that's been important for a long time. People have been getting married in marriage ceremonies for thousands of years.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That part about it, I kind of got over my the government doesn't need to codify my relationship. It's like, that's stupid. Of course it's dumb. So I just thought it's important to stand in front of everybody and say, you're the person I'm going to try and do it my best with. And all these people here are witnessing me.
Yeah. So telling there's built in accountability then.
I'm accountable.
Yeah.
And so I think that's important. That's sort of why.
Wow. Good for you, man. I hope that you two are very happy. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Well, season 2 of Lodge 49 premieres August 12th on AMC. Wyatt Russell, thanks so much for talking with me. It's fun.
Thank you. Thanks, man.
Thanks again to Wyatt Russell for coming on the podcast. Don't miss the season 2 premiere of Lodge 49 on Monday, August 12th at 10/9 Central on AMC. Visit amc.com for more information. Be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on Apple Podcasts if you haven't already. And if you like what you're hearing, then rate and review us while you're there. 5-star reviews are the easiest way for new listeners to find us. Don't forget to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at KickassNewsPod. And feel free to email me with your thoughts, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. Until next time, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.